Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. Last month, a spokeswoman for the Kansas Department of Aging and Disability Services went on Facebook to indicate how she felt about a proposal from the League of Women Voters for a new college course on voting. Part of the class, The Thinking Goes, could deal with how to register to vote. In Kansas, that's not a simple task, with its requirements for birth certificates and the like. Well, on Facebook, the spokeswoman, Angela DeRocha, wasn't impressed. She wrote this, "So it takes an entire semester to learn how to register to vote? Really?" And then she added this, "Do we want these slow learners voting?" Because Angela DeRocha represents a department that serves the disabled, her remark about slow learners lit up social media. And that raises a question for our ethics professors. Should government officials post their personal opinions on public issues on social media? Later on today, we'll wrestle with the issue of what moral responsibilities adult children have when it comes to their parents and end-of-life care. The ethics professors are Wayne Vaught. He's dean of the UMKC College of Arts and Sciences. He's also a professor of philosophy, medicine, and bioethics, and he's one of my bosses at UMKC. Wayne, welcome back. Nice to have you.
Oh, thanks for having me, Steve. Great to be here.
Clancy Martin is a professor in the Department of Philosophy at UMKC and a professor of business ethics at the Block School of Management. Clancy, nice to have you. Good morning.
Thanks so much for having us, Steve. Good morning.
Well, Wayne Vaught, let's turn to this thorny question of Angela DeRocha making this comment on Facebook. She may not have intended any harm, but harm it caused, judging by the social media reaction. Let's just stipulate that she has the right to say whatever she wants. This is a free country, after all. But the question more precisely is this: should government officials like Angela DeRocha be posting their personal opinions about the issues of the day on social media? What do you think?
Well, I would have to say, and to some degree, I would want to argue yes. I think that public officials should have a venue for articulating and expressing their personal opinions. One of the things I think that the American people, the voters, would want to know is actually what these people are thinking. So there's, to some degree, in which I think it can be actually helpful when people kind of put down their guard. She said, obviously, what was on her mind.
Right.
And now you have some insight into this person's personal perspective that should help inform votes in the future or actually could come back and could have her superiors have some ramifications for her in that regard. So, you know, I mean, it's a sticky issue because on the one hand, when you're an elected public official, what I think you should be doing in office is representing the people.
Right.
And that's not just the people that you happen to like or agree with, especially when you're in an office where your job is specifically to look out for people who have disabilities, as she was. And so for
and
her—
And she was not elected, just to clarify.
Absolutely
She's
correct.
She's a bureaucrat
absolutely correct.
In the Brownback
right.
administration.
And that's why yeah. I meant this could have negative implications for her position, or should have, if she is found— She's making statements that would bring into question her ability to effectively do her job. It could quite possibly have ramifications for that. So, you know, I think it really is kind of a difficult position because on the one hand, you would want to say, well, she shouldn't be making comments like that because she shouldn't be thinking of that, or she should have a broader perspective about the people that she is serving. On the other hand, this has provided a venue in which we can get some insight into some real limitations of the person who's in charge of the office that's supposed to be providing access to those access and support for those people. So I don't know, it's a mixed bag. On one hand, it seems like it gives us some power to do things to address a problem that we wouldn't have been able to readily address if she hadn't been so open and vocal about her position.
Well, let me get our listeners involved here before I have Clancy Martin weigh in here. Are you restricted by what you can write on social media because of the job you hold? If so, what are the restrictions and how do you feel about them? 816-235-2888 is our phone number here. Again, 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCUR Up to Date. Clancy Martin, weigh in here. We got a split verdict from your partner in crime, Wayne Vaught. Where do you come down here?
Well, I do think that we can all agree it was imprudent what she did. That's sort of non-controversial. She didn't exercise sort of good common sense. Now, what makes it kind of a morally fraught question is, are there norms that govern we know that there are norms that are that govern the sort of the professional ethical behavior of governmental officials.
Sure.
So, for example, we had an interesting conversation on this show about Kim Davis and the and the professional ethical norms that were governing her behavior and her conscientious
objection. She's the Kentucky County Clerk that wouldn't issue marriage licenses to gay couples.
Exactly. Yeah. And so when we're talking about particularly people who in one form or another represent the collective voice of the American people, that is, they are part of the governmental apparatus, we have this question about how far do their the norms of their professional ethical behavior extend. We know that they do have moral obligations based on the profession that they have embraced.
I've got obligations with the job I hold. I can't get on Facebook and say, here's a picture of my bumper. I've got a Donald Trump sticker.
Exactly.
Because I cover politics for the Star.
Exactly. Yeah. Right. There are norms that govern journalists. There are professional ethical norms, professional ethical norms that govern professors. Certainly, I'm extremely cautious about, and for good reason, not just prudential reasons, but also for reasons of professional ethics, recognizing that my students can see what I post on public media.
And I'm glad to hear that about you, Clancy. See, I had my doubts about you along those lines. You are showing some restraint. That's very, very good for you.
Well, it's not so much a question of restraint as it is a question of what might do some good versus what might do some harm. And but I appreciate that, Steve. Nevertheless, I will take the compliment.
Take it for what it's worth.
I'll take it for what it's worth. Very much. Thank you. Why we're talking about this, it seems to me, is that when you are a representative of the collective public voice, we don't say voice naively. We're holding you accountable in terms of your relationship to the fact that you represent us. So we're holding you accountable not just for your actions, but also for your speech. So it does seem to me that at the very least, if we want to look for, you know, a maximally virtuous representative of the government, that maximally virtuous person would be very careful about what she or he said when it came to social media these days, because you can no longer assume social media operating the way it does right now, we can't assume the old private-public distinction that we used to have. Mm-hmm. Everything that you say, so-called in private on social media, you have to assume that it's public. You have to assume that it could be newsworthy. You have to assume that it could be interpreted as coming from with the full authority of whatever role you occupy in society.
And it's interesting that the government's spokeswoman herself came out and defended Angela DeRocha, saying, hey, she has the right to air her views. Mm-hmm. As a result, no apology was forthcoming. So it was very much out. She had the support of the Brownback administration to do what she did.
Right. It seems to me that it was the politically correct thing probably to do for them to support her because she dug her own, she'd made her bed at that point. However, it does not seem to me that I don't want to say that people who are members of the government don't have the right to free speech. Of course they have the right.
Of course they do.
Of course they have the right to free
speech. That's not the issue here.
The issue is whether what they're speaking about falls within the purview of what we might consider the domain of their professional ethical responsibility. So they might have to be particularly intelligent, virtuous, and use particular discretion when it comes to matters that are governed by those professional ethical norms. So this is, in this case, if she'd been expressing her opinion about, why someone should be on the paleo diet, obviously it's irrelevant. If she's expressing her opinion about, whether it's dangerous to swim in Australia, it's irrelevant.
But this is connected to her position.
It's directly connected to her position, to the role that she occupies. And we do see her as a voice for the government. And consequently, it seems to me that she actually has done something that we could say was morally inappropriate given her professional ethical code.
We're talking this morning with our ethics professors about this whole idea that even in a country that offers and provides free speech through the First Amendment, are there restrictions on folks, what they can say on social media because of the positions they hold? We're talking about a case out of Kansas that directly raised that question. 816-235-2888 is our phone number, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. Mary from Overland Park, good morning.
Good morning. I find it disappointing that in the conversation that you're having, no one has mentioned whether state government should or does have its own code of ethics for its employees to follow. I'm a member of the Society of Corporate Compliance and Ethics Officers, and that is something that is fundamental to a good compliance and ethics program for an organization. And it would spell out within that code of ethics the kinds of behaviors that are expected of employees of a particular organization.
And that's an excellent question, Mary. I guess, you know, I just pointed out that the department, the governor's spokeswoman came out and supported Angela DeRocha for doing what she did, which would imply to me that she passed any a question about an ethics code of some kind or another. But that's a fair point, Wayne.
No, I think it's exactly right, is that you do want to assume that there are codes of ethics and standards of conduct and that the person's following it. What we're getting into this is into this issue of free speech.
Mm-hmm.
And that is it's one of the most sacred of rights that we have and we recognize in the United States. And we don't want anything to interfere with that. And even, you know, philosophers, we could bring up any, you know, free speech is one of those things. The person, the right of a person to say things even that are wrong, that are in some sense potentially harmful, should be protected because the right of free speech promotes, at the end of the day, the overall good of the community. Whenever you're trying to censor or restrict or constrain something, especially speech, is that when you have the opportunity for harms, unintended harms, to potentially occur. And so, you know, but as Clancy's pointed out, you're getting into an area where this is a person who is in charge of an organization that's directly responsible for oversight and providing services for a group of people and has seemed to say something that is disparaging to that very group of people. Now, she may want to come back and argue, well, this is what I intended or this is what I meant or had some opportunity to defend herself. So, I mean, by and large, it's very difficult for me to step off a position of advocating and supporting the right of an individual's freedom of speech to speak, mm-hmm. even especially in privately. It wasn't like this was a formal memo out of the office of that position saying this is the position of this office. This was my response, my personal reflection on a deep issue that I might encounter in my work.
Bill from Miriam on the Kansas side. Good morning, Bill.
Yes, good morning. I think you're almost missing the point. I think she obviously should have the right to express her opinion, but since she does express it that way, I think she shows a total disrespect of the people she's working for and the department that she's working with. I think she should be fired. It's that simple. If she has that opinion, it's more like she wants to destroy the department.
All right, Bill, I appreciate it. You know, you do wonder, Clancy, about this idea of the governor's spokeswoman. If she had come out and apologized, you know, you wonder what the response might have been, but she didn't do that.
Right. And I mean, we're entering into a really fascinating area. There's a contemporary philosopher at Yale, his name is Jason Stanley, just published a book called How Propaganda Works that I recommend to all of our listeners that deals with these questions of, you know, because in a sense we're getting into deep questions about political correctness in speech, for example. What do our words mean given who we are and the roles that we occupy? And is the right to free speech as morally neutral as we like to pretend that it is? You know, that it's just a fundamental, and when we say, for example, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, well, that doesn't mean that the moral questions go away because all of a sudden we have a conflict. Take healthcare, for example. On the one hand, we ought to have liberty to control our own resources. On the other hand, we've got scarce medical resources and we want to redistribute wealth in order to, you know, make people who don't have access to healthcare healthier.
Yeah.
So we can't really dig in our heels and just say, well, it's the First Amendment, it's the right to free speech, people are entitled to say whatever they want. You know, that's being a little bit naive about the real impact that our words have, about the fact that there are certain words I can't say on the radio. There are certain words I can't say in polite society. There are certain words I should never say to my children because I don't believe that those words should ever be repeated. Now, when you take somebody who is and has a quite carefully defined professional responsibility, and she's appealing to the so-called privacy of a social media site for the justification for the fact of expressing what we all agree is an imprudent and blameworthy opinion, given her position in the government. That seems to me to be a very weak defense. You know, I was doing it in private. No, as a matter of fact, these days when you post something on Facebook, you're not doing it in private. And we all know that, and case after case after case has shown it. And I can guarantee you the dean sitting beside me is not going to just naively post whatever he thinks about, the legislature and how they allocate money to university system on his personal Facebook page, because he's thinking about his responsibilities as a dean. And I think the case is the same here.
Let's go to Richard from Kansas City, Missouri. Richard, you're on Up to Date. You're talking with our ethics professors. Good morning.
Good morning. Great conversation. I agree that social media, just because you access it through your phone or a device like that, does not mean that it's private. It is public. And it's really no different than 20 or 30 years ago, somebody giving an interview to a newspaper reporter or something, in effect, and how it's distributed.
That's right.
But my question and comment, I guess, is about using freedom of speech as a defense. This isn't the first time where, an employer or a corporation comes out and says, well, we can't do anything about it because it's freedom of speech. That's not their right to give or to use. That, as we refer to it, in my understanding, is a constitutional right. It means the government can't come in, say that you can or cannot say something. And in this case, the state administration is not the government. They're the employer. And so that's just a feint. You know, it's an excuse for, in this case, not holding their employees to proper account for what is clearly a conflict of interest, speaking on something like this in an area of that they're supposed to be dealing with impartially.
Makes sense.
No, I mean it does. The challenge here becomes, is this is a public employee, and public employees do continue to possess their right of free speech in a way that private employees might not. So it is, I think, a real quagmire, because on the one hand, this again wasn't stated out of her office. This wasn't a directive that was on letterhead from the state government. This was on a social media site where she was expressing a personal opinion. And ethically, I think it raises this real question about, what's the extent to which we should legally, but ethically protect freedom of speech. And that has been an issue that's been debated for hundreds of years. And it's one in which most people will, again, fall on the side of protecting free speech, even though you will have isolated incidences of where you are uncomfortable with that speech. Nonetheless, does the greatest good for the community.
Okay. Richard, thanks for the call. Let's go to Neil from Independence. Neil, you're on Up to Date.
Thanks, sir. The previous caller has negated much of what I wanted to say. I just want to bring out the idea that freedom of speech and First Amendment rights refer to government repression of speech, not the employer. I had, not being one of the most stellar employees of this organization, which was a prime contractor for the federal government, had a little problem with a manager, and he told me I could never say a certain word again as long as I worked there, and that was harassment. I decided I'd take early retirement by suing the company, and went to an attorney, and the attorney said, take my advice, shut up, and go back to work, and don't say the word.
Clancy?
Yes, well, I mean, it's a great example, and it brings us back to what the earlier caller had said about professional ethical codes. I think that... she is right that we want as robust ethical codes as possible governing anyone who's in a possession of serious professional responsibility. And that's something where we actually would like to see an expansion of education, an expansion of certain kind of oversight, and an expansion of possible consequences for infractions of those professional ethical codes. So we have them for lawyers, we have them for journalists, we have them for doctors. We don't have them sufficiently for a lot of business professionals. It sounds like we don't have them, according to the caller, sufficiently for a lot of government officials. And what this lawyer was effectively telling the caller was, look, there's an implicit professional ethical code in place here. It's governing your speech in your workplace. Follow the professional ethical code.
Well, this hour we're visiting with our ethics professors, Wayne Vaught and Clancy Martin, both of UMKC. Now, gentlemen, a very different topic, and one that our two professors, I know you spend a lot of time talking and thinking about with your students. What moral responsibilities do adult children have for their parents in regards to end-of-life care? Clancy, frame this one for us. What are the issues here?
Well, there's a few different issues. There's this large issue of how do we handle end-of-life care? What's a morally appropriate way to handle end-of-life care? So when you're thinking about that, you're, of course, thinking about resources. We're thinking about quality of life. Mm-hmm. We're thinking about, of course, the desires of the person who is dying. That person, in some circumstances, for example, a person may wish to die and yet their family is wanting to keep them alive.
Yes.
And that
awful situation.
I've witnessed that in a hospice situation myself. I've spent a lot of time visiting different people in hospice at the end of their life and seeing all kinds of different family situations. And then, of course, these questions about the way in which if there is means available and a hospice worker has kind of instructed the family how a person might sort of make their exit from life a little more gracefully, those questions. There's also this question of a kind of straightforward moral question of what obligation do we have to our parents? Do we have really robust moral duties because they gave us life and because they cared for us all those years? Some people argue that, particularly in the Eastern tradition, in Confucianism, in Buddhism, or there's an emerging consensus in Western thinking about this issue that we didn't choose to be born, we didn't choose to have our parents raise us, so we don't have as robust a moral obligation as some people might think. We have more like a relationship of deep friendship or something like that when it comes to caring for our parents. Mm-hmm. So there's a whole host of really fascinating moral issues that come into this. And actually, Wayne's an expert on some of the bioethical issues of this end-of-life care.
Yeah, and you're smiling appropriately there. Yeah, right. You've been called an expert today by your partner. That's not a bad thing.
Raises the bar a little too high.
Yeah.
I think coming back to, and it'd be interesting to hear what the listeners actually do think about this, but the issue that Clancy has phrased in the initial question that you asked is, what is the nature of the moral obligation that we as children have to our parents, particularly when they're reaching the end of their life, when their care needs become greater and greater? And there have been an interesting number of articles written on this. One is whether it's reciprocity is the basis for the moral obligation. So your parents raised you, they sent you to college, they did X, Y, and Z. They've done a lot of things for you when you were children and gotten you into adulthood. Now, as that has flipped, where they're the ones now in need of care, the same sort of care in many regards as you needed, in many ways, the same care that you needed when you were children and infants. Now your parents are needing that as well. Do you have a moral obligation that arises from the reciprocity, that is, you're repaying them for the debt that you incurred when you were a child? Because Clancy sort of raised, one, you didn't ask to be born, you didn't, but do parents, because well, they had you, and you're incapable of taking care of yourself, and so they have to feed you and clothe you, and there are certain ethical obligations that we think parents clearly have to their children. Parents were not particularly, you know, they didn't do a lot of good for you, or they couldn't pay for you to go to college, or they, you know, were restricted in some of the things they could provide for you. Does that mean, well, now that you're in, you were only able to do so much for me, so I'm only going to be able to do so much for you? Some of the ethicists have sort of tried to abandon that and to think that, you know, when you try to look at reciprocity as a way of trying to understand the ethical obligation, it gets really kind of messy and confusing. And so they others have suggested that, well, really the ethical obligation concerns, and this is the other point Clancy mentions, from friendship. What's the nature of my relationship with this person now? And because of the nature of that relationship, does it incur certain ethical obligations that I have because of the good of that relationship?
In other words, for one person, that relationship might be one thing. That obligation might be one thing. For somebody else, it might be something else completely.
It might be completely different. And, and so it would be difficult to say. And you'll see situations where this sort of happens. You, particularly children who are scattered around the country, and the aging parent is in one place and takes a lot more of the responsibility for caregiving than do the siblings who might be scattered out. But, you know, what's been the relationship with those siblings over the years? Do they have as much of an ethical obligation to kind of come in and do things and provide care or financial support? And it's an interesting question about what is the basis. We're not, you know, arguing that there isn't obligations to care for our aging parents, but what's the ethical basis for that obligation, and how can we kind of, you know, effectively untangle the complications? Because, you know, you could have children who have had really bad relationships with their parents, and maybe it was the parent who was, you know, kind of the responsible party in that bad relationship. And so now they reach their elder years.
Yeah.
Do you have an obligation to this parent who mistreated me as a child and didn't do things for me and was not actually helpful to me during my formative years?
Yeah. For obvious reasons, these questions become particularly acute when we're at the end of life.
I was just going to say, I was going to raise that question with our listeners here. Let me just get our listeners involved here. If you have a question about the moral responsibilities that adult children have for their parents in regard to end-of-life care, give us a shout. 816-235-2888 is our phone number, or tweet us at KCUR UpToDate. What about the hypothetical you raised? It's not so hypothetical for a lot of people, Clancy, at the start of this segment, this notion, you know, what do you do at end of life for a parent? A parent may have prescribed ahead of time that he or she wants to leave this earth under certain circumstances, but then the children are gathered around and the children are saying, we don't want to go there. Whose needs come first? Whose rights and obligations come first?
I was recently speaking with a hospice caregiver who was a hospice psychologist. You know, they have hospice nurses, hospice therapists, a variety of people that help with the process of dying through hospice. She had just dealt with this situation where the entire family wanted this person to go on living, and the dying mother was expressing a strong desire to just be, you know, for them effectively to pull the plug and let her peacefully die.
So a big disagreement here.
Yeah, very big disagreement. And they just thought, you know, mom, sort of the sun's going to come out tomorrow approach. Like, yeah, we understand you're depressed right now and you're tired of fighting, but we need you around and we think you're going to feel better too. So that's the problem. And how this particular hospice caregiver dealt with it, I thought was extremely morally appropriate. What she did was she engaged everybody in a conversation about why it is that you think your mother should keep on living? Can everybody try to be very honest about why? And then can you stop for a moment and let your mother interject about why it is that she wants to die? Mm-hmm. So they set up this, to use the word Wayne was using in a slightly different context, she set up this a communicative reciprocity so that on the one hand, the mother could see very clearly what the feelings and needs of her family members were, which, of course, she must have been aware of anyway, and more to the point, where all the children could see that it wasn't just that their mom was depressed or that she was giving up, but that she felt like she had really lived a full and complete life, and she felt like she had done everything that she needed to do, and that when they reached her similar stage in life, they too would want to have the liberty to be let go, basically, to say, okay, I've done my job now for you guys. You have to let me go. Mm-hmm. So it was a matter of creating a sort of maximally compassionate situation so that the kids could see that they weren't doing their mom any favors by saying, we love you so much, we don't want you to go. And as a matter of fact, they were doing just the opposite. They were doing her harm.
And so what happened? End the drama here for us.
At the end of it, they decided that it was appropriate to let their mom die as she wanted.
But they had talked it out.
But they had talked it out and they felt bad about it. And they came to realize what their mom sort of knew all along, which was that they were at a stage where they didn't desperately need her to come on to keep on living, and also that that they were doing her a disservice by they felt like they were just showing her love by saying, Mom, we want you to keep on living. But in fact, they were actually doing her a disservice.
Gentlemen, lots of phone calls here on this topic. Let's go to Jane from Kansas City, Missouri. Jane, you're on with our ethics professors, Wayne Vaught and Clancy Martin. Good morning.
Good morning. So I'm actually a child survivor of domestic violence. Mm. And for me, my parents are my abusers. And I've actually cut ties with them, but I know that they're reaching sort of their retirement years, and this is something I've been thinking about a lot. Because I have cut ties with them, do I still have a responsibility, because I am their child, to care for them in their old age, financially, emotionally, you know, be that support system for them? Or because they are my abusers, do I have the ability to say, actually, I'm not going to be responsible for this?
Boy.
Yeah. Do you feel comfortable reaching out to them at all and asking them what their perspective is on this question?
I haven't spoken with them in quite a long time, and that's very much to my mental health benefit. So I kind of don't want to reach out to them and ask them about this.
I once had a relationship with an older sister who, for reasons of feeling deeply victimized by this person, I stopped talking to her. I didn't talk to her for about 10 years. And then I found out from a phone call from my mother that she had been murdered. And so I missed the opportunity. And I'm not suggesting that your parents deserve you reaching out to them. But what I am suggesting is that there may come a time, and it might not be right now, but there may come a time where, for your own benefit, so you don't later down the road feel regret, that you might want to reach out to them. It sounds like right now is not the right time, but keep your mind open to the possibility that there may come a time, since you're asking yourself this question, that you may want to reach out and just so you don't have to live with regret.
Yeah, and I think if there are issues like that you are dealing with a health professional or some way and trying to wrestle with the own challenges there, emotional and otherwise. But if it's coming back, trying to turn this back into the ethical perspective, can we come up with an argument that would say that you have an ethical obligation to these people who, and we obviously don't want to know or have you talk about the details of it? But I would think that clearly there could be situations where such a great harm has been caused that there's no ethical obligation at all on the part of the abused person to now have an obligation to take care of the people simply because they gave birth to someone, if the abuse was a particular traumatic nature.
Profound.
So
I
without knowing the details of the case, and we try not to get into sort of always answering these sort of real practical questions, but I would have to think that a compelling argument would be made that no, there's no ethical obligation to take care of one's abusers.
Gene, I'm sorry you're having to deal with this
absolutely.
Dilemma. I wish you the best as you wrestle with it.
Thank you so much.
You bet. Good luck. Alicia from Kansas City, Missouri. Alicia, you're on up today. Good morning.
Good morning. I just wanted to bring up something that I hadn't heard mentioned yet, and that is many, I worked in hospice for a number of years, and many children often grapple with choices that their parents made during their lifetimes, which leave them in a situation where now the children are having to either take care of them financially, physically, emotionally. So, you know, people saying, well, mom, if, you know, we told you to smoke, stop smoking for a number of years, or dad, we told you to take your medication you never wanted to, or we asked you to stop gambling and to save your money for when you needed it, and now you're begging me not to put you in a nursing home, but I'm spending my savings, you know, having in-home care for you. So I just thought I'd bring that up as a complication, I guess, that many, many children experience with their parents.
Thanks a lot, Alicia. Boy, those are terrific questions. And
no, they really are. And these, I mean, we're getting down into the nitty-gritty of incredibly difficult ethical quandaries. But this is an issue that has been and is attempted to be dealt with by a number of ethicists who say that, you know, the American bioethics movement had really been largely individual focused, autonomy focused, the right of the person we were talking about earlier about rights of free speech. And a lot of the push has been looking at, you know, ethically, you have to consider the patient as part of a family, and certainly the patient within a family. And so, yes, this person who is now one who's done things that have caused the harm to themselves, that have resulted in the diminished capacity that they now have, that's causing them to need additional assistance that this person either financially or physically is incapable of providing. And it becomes really difficult for what's known as the sandwich generation. Mm-hmm. There's these middle-aged adults with children and with aging parents who are caught in a situation of having to provide care at both ends of the spectrum, and it causes great emotional and physical harms and health problems for these caregivers, and there have to be legitimate limitations to that, and a person in the home can't just expect, well, you ought do everything I need exactly the way I want it to be to provide me with the type of autonomy I want, because that might be actually causing great harm to the people that you're asking to provide you with.
There is
care.
A sense on the part of the aging parent, I'm supposing here, that they think, well, I'm the one in trouble here. I should be able to get whatever I want whenever I need it. And you're suggesting maybe not.
I'm suggesting that the aging person, one, in a normal sort of situation, probably that we could argue that there's some moral expectations that the person has from their children to provide certain types of care. Nonetheless, it's not sort of carte blanche, I would think, that, you know, they need to be thinking, well, what is my request? What's the impact of my request or need on my family? And is that causing a harm to them that could be ameliorated if I did something else?
Yeah,
and it ought to be considered within that context, not just what I want as a patient or an aging person, but how is this impacting the range of people that are part of my circle of friends and caregivers?
And part of this conversation is all three of us sitting around the table are parents, and we know that eventually we're going to get to this stage of life, and what are our moral obligations right now to our children to do those kinds of things to prepare ourselves and to prepare our children for the fact that eventually we're going to be at end of life. I know if I said to my daughters, one day I want you to take care of me in my infirmity, they'd say, well, start putting aside money right now, Dad, because I'm not guaranteeing you that I'll be able to do it.
I don't want this recorded at all, because this is going to come back I mean, I get this every day. You need to be doing X. Why aren't you taking this medication? Why aren't you doing things to be more healthy? Because, well, right now I'm healthy, but at some point I'm going to have these infirmities, and it's going to be the very same issue that the caller raised. Is that you were not doing things to keep yourself in the best of health, and now
we have moral obligations right now.
Your moral sins are causing harm to a different generation.
Roxanne from Lenexa. Roxanne, you're on with the ethics professors. Good morning.
Good morning. I'm the parent. I am the aging parent. I have had an end-of-life discussion with my children, and they know what my wishes are. Finances are not involved on their part or my part, but I want them to let me go when I want to go.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Excellent. And, yeah. you've had those conversations.
That's one
of the most important things that that people can do. And it's one
talk
of the things.
Talk about it now, not then.
Absolutely.
Right.
Talk about it when you can talk about it and express it and get it in writing and have these conversations with your family so that your wishes are expressed. And there are so many people who don't want to have that conversation and are uncomfortable with that conversation.
The other part of this I want to say is, society and the medical profession needs to honor my wishes.
Absolutely.
Absolutely, yeah. And that's, I mean, there's a wonderful book that was a bestseller, so you may have heard of it, called Being Mortal by Atul Gawande, in which he dealt with his father, who was a Harvard physician, and he himself is a Harvard physician. And when his father was dying, he suddenly discovered that he was completely powerless, despite the fact that he was contacting, he was consulting with his own colleagues. Nevertheless, mm-hmm. suddenly his own colleagues weren't listening to him. They weren't taking him seriously. He was being increasingly disenfranchised as his cancer advanced. And this is not uncommon. In fact, it's quite common, so common that it could happen to a Harvard physician being done by other Harvard physicians. It's absolutely true that part of this equation are the kinds of costs that will be inflicted upon a family by mm-hmm. medical professionals who perhaps aren't thinking about alternatives like hospice or would rather proceed with an aggressive treatment.
Well, I think what we need to do is come back and revisit end-of-life issues because
absolutely.
The board lit up so many important topics to run down and discuss in a responsible way like we try to do here. Our ethics professors, once again, are Wayne Vaught, the dean of the UMKC College of Arts and Sciences, Clancy Martin, a professor in the Department of Philosophy, also at UMKC. Gentlemen, I always appreciate it. Thanks very much.
Thanks so much, Steve. It's a pleasure.